7 minutes past the hour of 12, 4341790. You can also email me at peter.w.wickham@gmail.com. People like Talbot will remain in the position he's in because all he wants to be do is to be heard, and he used to support Philip Graves up there in Eden Lodge to get what he wanted. He's still up in Eden Lodge. I don't want to read the rest of this because it's not pleasant. Peter, I'm a regular listener from New York, saying a gentleman thinks that the DLP will win so much seats, and he could run in St. Thomas to see what happens if he saves his deposit. Down to brass tacks, good afternoon. Good afternoon and welcome, you're on the air. Good afternoon and welcome, you are on the air.
Mr. Wickham, good afternoon to you.
How are you doing, sir? How are you doing, Uncle?
Pretty well. I've been listening this morning, mm-hmm. and if I wait until next week to call to correct some misinformation that went out, then it would not be doing justice to the station.
That's fine.
First, you listen, and this is coming from a call who calls himself the historian. And I just want to explain some circumstances here. The building on Proben Street that was built was not built as the National Insurance Building. The building on Proben Street was built at the National Saving Bank. You were perfectly right when you said the National Insurance opened elsewhere. The National Insurance opened in the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in the Queen Elizabeth Hospital. National Insurance, and there were 58 people employed at the time.
And do you still work out of the old hospital?
Out of the old hospital, right? Then eventually, the new building, which was opened on the 3rd of December, 1975, by Her Majesty the Queen. This is where the National Insurance Building, the National Insurance was incorporated into that building with the saving bank. This is a fact. I am not guessing what I'm trying to tell you. Because when one says that, as far as they're concerned, that it was built as the National Insurance, but it was not built as the National Insurance.
Point is taken.
When one told you that the National Insurance was not any place else, and you insist, well, I thought that it was some place else. You were perfectly right. It was in the old hospital building. I also want to establish that in 1994, when the Barbados Labour Party won the government, one of the first issues on the agenda was the correcting of the pension, parliamentary pension schemes. And you will remember that there were back dates and several politicians were put on the pension scheme. For example, we could say a former minister of communication and works of the Democratic Labour Party. What we must explain here is that, in truth and fact, as I understand it, it was backdated to give them the pension, and they got the pension. It was also established that to receive a pension, you would sit in Parliament for 8 consecutive years. Eight consecutive years in Parliament. And that was established in 1994 when the Barbados Labour Party came into power in terms of correcting the pensions of some parliamentarians. All of that is documented. So I am saying that these are things that are part of the history of Barbados. And if you don't have them right, then obvious. And I'd like to establish here, in 1967, on the 5th of June, was when, as far as I'm concerned, what I'm saying here is when it was tabled in Parliament. So one cannot say that the National Insurance Building that just got pushed down was built for the National Insurance. That was not. That was built at the Government Saving Bank. And they were occupied the ground floor. And then eventually, there was so much business done with the National Insurance in that year period. So much business done. This had started with the staff of 58. And eventually when they moved to Fairchild Street, Proven Street, they had a staff of 158.
That's an important piece of history, and I appreciate you very much for you drawing that to our attention. The reality of where things started out and where they ended were important. I think the footnote that he was making is the suggestion that essentially government took down a building that didn't belong to them. But I think the more salient point has been made by you. So thanks a lot. I appreciate the intervention and for you to clarify. Of course, I have no knowledge of these matters because the buildings are certainly all of that initiative would have taken before I open my eyes into this world. Thanks for calling. Down to Brass Tacks, good afternoon. Good afternoon and welcome.
Hello.
Yes, good afternoon. You're on the air, sir.
Yes, Mr. Wickham.
Yes, sir.
Could you tell me when the National Insurance started?
The gentleman just said it. He said 1965 or something like that.
1955?
I don't remember the exact date. Don't crucify me. But I believe I just heard that Mark was saying it was 1965.
65?
Mm-hmm. Why you ask?
You had a caller.
Right.
That claimed that Mr. Barrett and Mr. Agnew Crawford started National Insurance.
Okay.
But you know Mr. Crawford and Mr. Barrett followed in 1966.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe a year after.
National Insurance started after independence.
I thought he just said something about 1965.
Yeah. And not 1954.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
National Insurance started in after 1966.
Mm-hmm.
Could be the same year, but after.
Okay.
And that caller telling you about Mr. Crawford started with Mr. Barr. Mr. Barr and Mr. Crawford broke up for independence.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a caller yesterday, not really you, but the program had a caller who said Mr. Barr fought for independence. Mr. Barr didn't fight for independence. The only one he fought, really, I had a fight with, was Mr. Crawford.
Okay.
And the next thing is, when National Insurance started, you know, like how Ms. Martley now asking people to join the BOSS program? They tell you once you work and you got to pay a National Insurance to deduct your money. It wasn't no one. You're signing up nothing, so... To send a national, once you pay National Insurance, they send a card to you. And automatically you become a member. And it was right now it is beneficial to people. Nobody don't know if the boss would be the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I figure people should wait and see what would be the benefit they would get. And I know it would be benefit. Yeah.
Dennis is just reminding me that it's 66, would be the 4th of July, 1966. I actually just checked their website and they have identified some precursors like the Sugar Workers Provision Fund, the Pensions Act, 1947, Pensions Act, again, it was 1938, the Widows and Orphans Pensions Act, Workmen's Compensation, and the Poor Law Relief Act. All of these were precursors to National Insurance, and I sense that in 1966 everything was consolidated under the National Insurance. So.
No, your caller there that spoke about this National Insurance, and he's telling you want to make people in Barbados believe he know everything about the politics in Barbados. You know, he come over he went to our branch meeting in St. John. And he come and tell us how he is this professional canvasser. That's the guy, you call him the taxi man.
Mm-hmm.
How he put Liz Thompson in the House of Assembly. And he come with the expectation that our representative would hire him to go canvassing. But the people in the branch did the job, and people get fed up with the Democratic Labor Party. Alvin and all those are talking about who they get back in Wesley, all of that. But I'm looking forward some day soon there won't be no more Democratic Labor Party.
So you're looking forward to that?
Yes. But that record, you may every time they have power, there's some kind of thing with it. Taxpayers' money. That was it got at Duffus Commission. But before Duffus Commission, it was the Minister of Housing. Mr. Barr had to fire him. And then Mr. Barr was threatened, if he don't reinstate him, what would happen?
Mm-hmm.
He would let the cat out the bag. He was reinstated. Then we had the St. Joseph Hospital. You know, I can go on. Every time there was in power, there was every taxpayer's money. What credibility they have coming back, telling you about they're coming back to run Barbados. And the next thing, they don't have no talent. There's no talent in the Democratic Labour Party.
All right, sir. Thanks for your contribution. That's it? Or you had something else you wanted to raise? That's it. Okay. Thanks a lot for the contribution. Let's see if we can get another caller in, or two maybe, because we are only on 18 past 12 and we can go to 12:30. So let's say good afternoon and welcome.
Good afternoon, Peter.
Yes, sir. How are you?
Fine. As a political scientist, what you think are the advantages and disadvantages of a general election being held in Barbados next year?
I don't know that there are any real advantages. This question came up recently regarding the impact of COVID on elections, especially in light of the fact that the St. Kitts election went so well for the incumbent. I've expressed the view that natural disasters appear to help incumbents. And in a situation like that, it would make sense if you have an election to bring it up closer to now, to get it out of the way, simply because your short-term mitigation efforts are likely to be successful. Your long-term mitigation efforts are more challenging and more uncertain. So in that context, one could argue that if the Barbados Labour Party brought up our election to a time that is soon, they would do better than they would be able to do, let's say, in a few years or in a year or probably a little more than that, because that would be the time that the long-term reality of COVID would hit. Having said that, however, I don't believe that the Barbados Labour Party is in a position to do that for a couple of reasons, or needs to. One is that the election is not due for another 3 years, and I think that by that time, things may very well get back to normal. And the other point is that I don't believe the BLP is fearful of losing an upcoming election in the way that Team Unity, for example, in St. Kitts and Nevis may have been concerned about not being able to win. So for those two reasons, I'm not likely to see it as being beneficial, but it could be in theory if they wanted to capture the COVID. Is that a reasonable response for you, sir?
Those are the only, there are not really any advantages and so on.
But that's what I just said. The advantage is that it could help you to win. But if you feel you're going to win anyhow, then, you know, what's the advantage? You would like an election call early?
Well, there are some advantages that I see.
For example?
Well, first of all, the opposition parties are in disarray.
Mm-hmm.
So if you call an election next year, there won't be any extensive campaigning that you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
Two persons are calling for the downsizing of the cabinet. And if an election is held, the electorate would make that decision instead of the prime minister having to make that decision. Three, the persons who came in under the coattail of the prime minister would now have a chance to see if they have any standing in their constituencies. And four, there are persons who don't intend running again when the election is called. So that would give the opportunity for those persons who are about to replace them to get a footing.
Um, Interesting analysis. My question to you, though, sir, would do you believe that the 2 years that's needed, well, the 2 years between now and 2023 would change a whole lot?
Well, no, we have the pandemic where everybody is saying that the government is doing a good job, so the government should be in good standing with the electorate. Mm. And I think they could recapture the 30 seats, all 30 seats.
Well, which is my point, that if recapturing all 30 seats is your objective, who is to say that you're not likely to recapture it down the road either?
I don't know.
Because the opposition doesn't appear to be doing well. My thing is that if you have 30 seats and you call a snap election, it feels that you're taking advantage of the other guy, because the other guy doesn't have any, and you know that he's not in a position to fight. This is what was done in Antigua when they called the election about 2 years early. The prime minister called the election. He won more seats than he had going in. But the concern on the ground was that he was taking advantage of an opposition that was ill-prepared. And, you know, people felt that he could wait the full time. Compare him to Keith Mitchell, who, after he won all the seats, waited until till 5 years had elapsed before he called the next election. Because he said he didn't want to give the opposition, he didn't want to give people the impression that he was trying to, what they would call, advantage the opposition.
But what I'm seeing is that you're trying to legitimize the opposition.
Not really, no. You mean by calling an election?
Yeah, by calling an election, you will give the electorate an opportunity to decide if they want an opposition or not.
But they will get that choice in 2023. Why they had to get that choice sooner? What it would do, it would impact on the one opposition MP. So certainly we would be saying goodbye to Reverend Atherley. But I don't know that you would want to call the election just so you could get rid of Reverend Atherley. You know?
All right,
sir. Thanks a lot for calling. All right, we have 5 minutes remaining. Let's see if we can get another call in. Good afternoon and welcome. You're on the air, 434-1790. Good afternoon,
Mr. Wickham. How are you this afternoon?
I'm good, sir. Yourself?
I'm fine. Mm-hmm. First, I would like to make a few references here. First, I would say that Mark Williams was right in what he said, because the first National Insurance, when it was formed, it was set up just in the back of the old General Hospital, not the 2-acre, the back of the old General Hospital. I would like to say that at this point in time, I am appalled at the mouthings and the things of the former administration. People who comes to the program at this point in time, and I have not observed really that in what is going on now, something named circumstance has come into play, because when the Barbados Labour Party came into government, there wasn't a sight that this COVID-19 would have come in place. And one of the things that strikes me when I listen to them is, if it had happened when they were in government, or if it had happened and they were returned in government and it was under them, what would have happened to this country? And what would have happened with us all? And my advice to them would be, as I would say to them, I believe that they should sit down and have a serious look at themselves. And instead of trying to pull down know what is going on in this country, given its circumstances, regroup. Find the leader of the and founder of the Democratic Labour Party, wherever he is in the Caribbean, apologize to what they did to Barbados and this and the Democratic Labour Party as a whole, and then come back to the people of Barbados. Because I am of the view, I was one, and I don't have no apologies to make about this. Because from June 2017, I predicted that there would have been a clean sweep across the country when they are called elections, and some of the people within the Barbados Labour Party who didn't believe so can tell you that I was saying that. And I don't have no problems, but I will advise them to look at the times, what is going on now, what this present Prime Minister is faced with, and the way she is going about it, the way things are happening. And at the same time, and by the same token, when they talk about boss ain't good and try to come first and foremost, I believe strongly that this boss program would have been one of the best things that you could think about to bring for workers. And I am sorry that it ain't going across the spectrum, because I believe a lot of Barbadians would have been would go into it, because they're not losing all. They are not losing anything. They are in the beginning. And therefore, this thing, like when it went and they had the 8% cut, and it was just the cut, and that was it. No. They are gaining from things from this. So therefore, that is the kind of leadership that we are talking and we are portraying and seeing under the Barbados Labour Party. Mm-hmm. Now, I believe, beyond any shadow of a doubt, that everybody is calling and they are criticizing a large cabinet. But I am one of the Barbadians that believe I am seeing something completely different of what this large cabinet is producing. You know, it ain't only that the work or the ministry or the things that they are holding, but it is what I am seeing and what I am realizing, because I do believe that it is because of all of these ministries with the pieces that we are in, you try to start something, you hit a big rock.
Mm-hmm. All right, sir, we're going to have to run. I was trying to let you finish a comment. I want to thank you so much for calling and making a contribution. Down to Brass Tacks, we were on 4341790. We had, more than half of the program. We continue until 2 o'clock. It's just over an hour remaining of programming for you. You can also email me at peter.w.wickham@gmail.com. Or you can use the chat. Remember, the chat is 266-IVOB. That's 266-IVOB. Email here from Carl Moore. And he says, moderator, before we toss Admiral Nelson, the 200-year-old statue, into the Carenage, let's not forget that there's a living flesh and blood version among us. If he is mistakenly thrown into water, let's hope he can swim. Of course, he is referring to no less a person than Admiral Nelson. I have never been clear in my mind as to why Mr. Tony Nelson has taken the name the Admiral, but he's been the Admiral for all of the time that I've known him, and it seemed to work well for him. So the caution that Carl Moore is issuing is, just to be careful that we don't end up tossing him into the sea by accident, because that would be tragic, in my opinion. Another person writes, Peter, I would like to add an email to you just to read. I'm a Bajan American. My sons and grandchildren are Americans. My sons and I went to war for America, and we're all asking for the system to give us the same respect it gives to white people, and for Barbadians to support the sons and daughters of its soil. We sent remittances home that helped to prop up the economy, and certainly we think that we should expect no less. Which is in a similar tone to the question that was put from my friend in Miami as well earlier today. So those are two notes from the Barbadian diaspora in the United States, suggesting that there are good reasons why we need to, you know, be on board with these issues. Down to Brass Tacks, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Wickham.
Yes, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. You?
I'm good.
Right, Raul here.
Hey, Raul. How are you doing? Good to hear you.
I'm okay, thanks. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to make two comments here today. One, you know, there's all this furor and cutting trust and talk about the the boss and all of, even there's something, you came across an article about the sunset severance legislation.
I didn't read an article about it.
The sunset severance and the extended time for employees and that kind of thing. But one question I want to pose to you, with all the goings on, if the boss is not hired, et cetera, it is say that they want to create elbow room and that kind of thing. If that is not hired, the next question to be discussed or to be looked at will be the possibility or likelihood of persons being laid off. I don't know what would be your take.
I'm not really sure, sir.
Because it is a startup projects to create employment and sort of give some more impetus to the economy and funds to be had. It's, if you see the effort when you look at it, I think it would be laudable. And something has got to be done because this COVID has trusted the whole island in a dilemma economically, and you can't stop there in limbo. You've got to move on. I don't know what was your.
Yeah, we need to take whatever measures we can to get things moving again. And certainly, right. If that is it, then yeah, so be it.
Okay,
yeah. Agreed.
That's my take on it. Now, my second point is, don't expend your good energy. I often say this to you. There was a conversation just before the break about this snap election. I spoke to you when you remember when Mr. Lashley, former MP, was talking about. You and I had this discussion already about this snap election. Why Ms. Marley, with all of her achievement and all of her standing, you know, would have to talk about snap election and whatever. What I find very pathetic is, and that you highlighted something about the opposition or someone about the opposition parties. They're all in disarray. And you see, interesting enough, persons are saying traditionally we have got a certain type of opposition, and it was predominantly between government, opposition, BLP, DLP, and we have grown accustomed to that over the years. But now with the state of affairs with the DLP, that isn't likely anymore. Now the other parties are trying to come up to fruition, and right now there isn't anything to be had in regard of any solid going forward. Now that is so interesting in the whole analysis of opposition going forward for Barbados, that I don't know what's going to become of it. Now, the whole talk about the DLP, and they got to come, and that whole faction thing has got to be resolved. Now, if they remain adamant, it's going to be so interesting to see what will happen, because, you know, remaining adamant what's going to happen. And the three factions that I always say, like, is still there. Now, they're going to come to a compromise and say, let's bury hatchets. And if they're going to bury hatchets, they can't bury them, say, their foot, and they've got to go out in the desert and bury them and come back where they ain't got it where they mark. If you put it side your foot, you don't really bury, genuinely, you don't bury your hatchet, because if you scratch side your foot, you'll find it again. So to get that faction healed, that is what has got to be achieved. I don't know how likely that would be. Mm-hmm. But we at a real interesting juncture politically going forward. I know you being a political analyst and expert and a scientist will have your views. I would like to hear what you got to say, the way I've now put there.
What I find most interesting about the juncture is that we have numerically the strongest government in our history, and we have qualitatively the biggest problem that we've ever faced as a country. Mm-hmm. So that's the contrast that I find most fascinating. Big government, strong government, the largest in our history in terms of strength, and then also the biggest problems that we've ever faced as a nation economically have presented ourselves. So we had to see how those two things can work out. Hopefully one will help the other. All right, Rob?
Okay, all the best.
All right, take care. Thank you for calling. Good to hear from you. Down to Brass Tacks, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon, Mr.
Good afternoon, Mr. Stricker Senatory. How are you, sir?
Yes, how are you?
I'm good. And good to hear from you. Mm-hmm. A blessed and wonderful Friday to you.
Well, where the blessings coming from, Mr. Stricker?
Well, from yourself. We've been having rain, so that's blessing from on high. So whoever is on high.
But you know, Mr. Wickham, I just tell you, let me leave out
be on high. You know, you're either in or you're out. You know, don't want to be half in or half out. So you leave out the blessing, right? So, Mr. Wickham, on Monday when I spoke to you, surprisingly, when I finished, the Mighty Gabby came on after. And you and he had a lot to talk about Emerton and the greatest song and whatever. You all even went on to say that it could be an international song, that it can be sung wherever there is oppression. You could remember that?
Dispossessed people, yeah. People are removed from their land.
Yeah. Right. Yes, there. Well, I would like him to go right there in Bay Street and sing it. And instead of saying, look at what they do with my Emerton, they sing, look at what they do with my liquidation center. And when he done off of Bay Street, I want you to go round to the bar and get on the beach and sing Jack. That beach is mine too. So you see, we can't be looking, because remember we was looking at the Black Lives Matter and all these things. And we can't look at the oppressions on the far side and shut the eyes to the ones right here. So that was my concern and my take on it. But about the boss now.
Let me just make a very quick response. Over the years, your criticisms have been interesting. I have to admit that one is the one of the wittier ones that you have just presented, suggesting that Gabby could dedicate Emerton to Miss Ram. My only challenge with it is that the song Emerton is about, one could say, ancestral heritage. And I'm struggling to understand the ancestral heritage associated with Miss Ram owning that property, which she has owned, I think, for about 30 or 40 years. But let me finish.
No.
I let you finish, so you let me finish. And I'm saying that's my only challenge, that the idea of her being thrown off of land where her ancestors and forebears have built and toil and sweat is something that I'm struggling with, because to the best of my knowledge, she came into that property about 30 years ago and she would have owned it ever since, but it is now being acquired for a public purpose. So one would argue that the acquisition for a public purpose does more to help advance the cause of community ownership, namely the public, than what is currently the case. But you can continue to your second point after you respond to that.
Mr. Wickham.
Yes, sir.
Dispossessed is dispossessed regardless of how you get it, Mr. Wicker. She has been dispossessed of her legal property. So you can polish it however you want to polish it.
But she has been compensated.
No.
She will be compensated.
You say she will be?
She will be, yeah.
Oh, she will be.
Once she agrees on an amount that she should be compensated for.
Don't let me go further about the agreement or nothing else. The point is,
when Shamrock was moved to wait for thing, were they compensated immediately, or did they have to wait for the court to determine? Yes, sir.
The land is wanted
in
a private project. That should have been sold by private treaty. And I hope when it gets to the CCJ that they tell them go back. Let it be sold by private treaty. That's all
If the CCJ does not act on it, or if it doesn't go to the CCJ, if the government awards an amount of money, because bear in mind the right to acquire is not being challenged. What is being challenged is the value. You realize that? So she's not challenging government's right to acquire. She's challenging the amount of money she's being given, which is consistent with the aspect of the Constitution that tells you that you have a right to approach the court to determine whether the quantum is sufficient. And if it is not, the court can award a different quantum. And that was actually one of the first cases I read in law at the university, which is the Shamrock case. So
if you want,
she's doing exactly that, but there's no way that the court is going to say government didn't have the right to take the property, because that's not an issue.
But What about the right to sell it by private treaty?
But you take it, you can do whatever you want. If you take it, if I acquire it, I can do whatever I want. They can get it to you.
No, the prospective developers could buy it in private treaty. That's all I'm saying.
No, but it would have, isn't a lot tidier to acquire it. Because if she didn't want to sell it, which she didn't want to, you would have had a problem.
Mr. Wicker, you know how much people didn't want to sell? I end up selling. You take all the West Coast and think sell because people they want to sell. Mr. Wickham, we can leave that there.
Let's do that. Yes.
Right.
Next point.
No, the boss, right? And I listened to Dr. Kevin Greenidge, and he said that it has been so cleverly done. But in bookkeeping. The public servant is getting paid on the war book.
Strickers, you got something beeping in the background?
Yeah. That was the door.
Okay.
I
thought that you were driving a van or reversing or somebody trying to blow you up or something. Because I would be concerned.
The van park, but the door didn't pull right
there. Okay.
Sorry about that.
I didn't want anybody to blow you up, so...
Well, you don't worry about that kind of things. I don't live that kind of life.
Mm-hmm.
That on the payroll books, those that get in over $3,600 a year, it will show that a percentage is in cash and a percentage is in bond. And that is the book that will be shown to the IMF. If the keepers has got more than one book and they just cut the book, so it's just another matter. I don't know. The point is that standard cooking the book, Mr. Wickham. What you gonna say with that?
Your analysis is a little complicated for me this afternoon, so a lot of it went over my head. I was able to deal more with the first point you were making, but this second point about the boss, I think, you know, my struggle with this whole thing, you know my view on it, I support it, I think it's a fair program, I think it is an attractive program for some people, and my advice is very simple. If you cannot afford to go without the money, I would say decline it. If you need the money for that reason, to pay bills or to do whatever, then you have to decline it. If, however, you were planning to save some of that money, then it is better that you do it there than do it elsewhere. So for me, it's easy. But you guys are getting into some serious contusions over it. And no, I appreciate that it's good political fodder, but it doesn't excite me.
Mr. Wickham,
yes, sir.
You know, it is no serious contusion.
It's contusions. Maybe not serious contusions, but contusions nonetheless.
If you wanted all of your money, then your paybook should reflect that. And it is not reflecting that, Mr. Wickham. The book that going to the IMF ain't reflecting that.
So yeah, but you're getting all the money.
I don't see what... That's standard. Cooking the book.
An interesting conversation taking place right now in Antigua and Barbuda, and I'm not trying to pick on any country. The government of Antigua and Barbuda has signaled that it already has signaled that it will not be in a position to meet its salary obligations for the month of June, at the end of June. So they have put people on notice that they may get half the money or some of them may not get any at all, but they have already indicated that. And the reason for that is very simple. The Prime Minister there has indicated, like the Prime Minister here, that their revenues in terms of collection are down significantly, and as a result, they're not able to meet their salary obligations. And they're down significantly because the country was in shutdown. There was no revenue being generated. It's a tourism-dependent economy like ours. The difference in Antigua is that Antigua doesn't have a central bank that they can borrow money from in the way that we can, if necessary. And as a result, they often have these issues where, you know, there's a shortfall because there are no indigenous banks and whatnot that they can draw on. And as a result, they end up with these cash flow issues. All I'm saying to you is that while you guys are anxious to jump up and down and abuse the Motley administration for using bonds as a way of meeting people's salary obligations. Just bear in mind that there are places in which salary obligations ain't getting met because the money in there. And I'm saying if the money is there in some way, shape, or form, I think we ought to be happy that this is the capacity of the government of Barbados as distinct from a situation where a prime minister can go in a public forum and tell you, buddy, we ain't no money. And technically speaking, our prime minister could do the same thing too, because she would be in her right to say, we can't pay what we don't have. And if you shut down the country and no revenue is being collected, how are you going to get paid?
Mr. Beckham.
All them teachers at the home sitting down, all of them different public servants and clerical offices and whatnot that couldn't go to work, right? Or home sitting down or watching Netflix. They're getting paid.
Mr. Beckham, I don't support that, see?
What, is not true?
One thing, let me tell you, see? Salaries must be paid and on time. That's one of the things that I preach when I did my working day.
So you're disagreeing with Gaston Brown in Antigua?
I am saying that salary must be paid and on time. I don't want any stress paid. When you see pay there come, salary should get the money or they should be notified. It can be later or whatever. So I don't support that. It is unfortunate that he would now have to say to the workers that they can be short or non-existent payment. I don't support that. Salary should pay it on time.
All right.
If in our case and we decide that we can work out a deal, well, then we work out a deal. But to come with this clever, you know, trying to fool people is some fantastic thing. There's nothing.
I think it's pretty fantastic that people are being paid here and people in Antigua are not being paid. I think that's pretty fantastic.
There's nothing fantastic about a worker. Like,
because I tell you, there are some situations in which companies have said, look, as a result of the lashes that we took in COVID, we are closed permanently. We are not able to reopen. All of the people who are employed have to be severed forthwith because we just can't make, right? I happen to know a small business person who did a very, very good trade on his South Coast. And, you know, the reality is that he said, basically, when he closed for COVID, he closed for good. Everybody who was there gone home. No, that's the reality in so many instances. Government, technically speaking, should not have that luxury. But it faces the same challenge because you have to meet salary expenditure, which is a significant part of the money that government pays, out of revenue that comes in. When there's no revenue coming in, how are you going to meet the outgoings?
Anyhow,
I'll let you say the final response and then we will go.
Now that you go on there, let me show you something, right? These supermarkets, they remain open and they had more customers in the shorter hours than they would have normally had in the longer hours. The staff stood up to it and worked long hours, do everything for them. And as soon as it is up, they send them home, Mr. Wickham. They show nothing to say that when I work long and hard, let me try with winner. And they make probably the same money. I don't want to be too hard and fast, but probably make the same money they would have made after they open the long hours, or possibly more, because the people were shopping left, right, and center with all kind of groceries and all sort of things. So it wasn't a shortage. The hours were shorter, but the amount of sales was there. I don't know what other expenses they would have had that might have taken away, so I don't want to say they make money because sometimes it only seems so. But I'm saying after the workers show the loyalty coming to work with the COVID on and this thing, take the chances, then they may take now with them, Mr. Wickham. Okay. What are you telling me?
All right. I want to thank you, Mr. Stricker Stanley Tree. It was good chatting with you as always.